Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I am Wander Fox, your host. And as you know, you are listening to 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. So on today's show, I'm going to continue with a talk that I started last week on this show by Michael Pollan. He is an author, a journalist. He's written several books, including Food Rules. That's his latest book. He also wrote Omnivore's Dilemma and several other books about food. And he's an amazing speaker. And so I'll go ahead and get started with the second part of his talk, Deep Agriculture.
Fossil fuel. So how do you get your system off of cheap fossil fuel? That's what I want to walk you through. You need radical reforms at three levels. Reforms that are going to take a long time. Reforms that have some serious obstacles before them. The first is on the farm. I want to talk a little bit about agriculture. The key to getting farms off of fossil fuel is figuring out how you produce lots of biomass without it, right? Amazingly enough, nature produces huge amounts of biomass every year without fossil fuels, without pesticides, without fertilizers. How does it do it? And we have understood this for a long time. In fact, some of the intellectual history of this organization dovetails with that knowledge, and that is in 1971, and this really is the beginning of the modern food movement, I think, Wendell Berry published an article in the Whole Earth Catalog introducing Americans to the work of Sir Albert Howard, an English agronomist who'd spent a lot of time in India studying peasant agricultures in the 30s, and he explained that the way you did it was you modeled your system on nature. Whether you're talking about a forest or a prairie, these systems were sustainable. They renewed their fertility. They had cycles of growth and decay, and they dealt with pests through biodiversity, through many, many species. You did not find monocultures in nature. And that has basically been the core idea since then of organic agriculture. How do you best mimic those systems and move from monoculture to polyculture, which is to say growing many crops in rotation or symbiotically? The power to produce huge amounts of food from such systems has been proven. Producing huge amounts of foods basically from sunlight, soil, and water at very different scales. And I've written about some of it. If you read Omnivore's Dilemma, I described Joel Salatin's remarkable farm, which is now has many, many imitators in California. This orchestrated five-species dance of creatures that produces huge amounts of meat from very little land. But we have proof that you can do this at large scales too. And one interesting case is Argentina, where you have farms of 5 and 10,000 acres, bigger even than the farms you find in Iowa today or Nebraska. And they have this very clever rotation, which is to say that they graze ruminants, mostly cattle, on grass for 5 years rotationally, and this grazing builds up so much fertility in the soil, so much carbon in the soil, that they can then plow those perennial pastures, and get 3 years of grain, corn, soy, whatever they want, without any fertilizer whatsoever, without any pesticides, because the weeds that would be a problem in the pastures can't survive tillage, and the weeds that would be a problem in tilled fields can't survive years of perennial. So we know you can do this. And a lot of it depends on redefining our sense of what a clever technology is. And what I suggest is that a really smart rotation, like that 8-year rotation in Argentina, is as clever and powerful a technology as the latest genetically modified seed. And we need to look at it that way. The question is, why don't we look at it that way? Well, by and large, because there's nothing to sell in the case of the rotation. And what makes agriculture really work in a sustainable direction are processes more than products, which is why there's very little R&D that goes into developing these technologies. So one of the things we need to do is shift our research agenda in that direction and not count on private companies who will not be able to figure out a way to lock up the intellectual property of a really good relationship between chickens and cows and pigs on a farm. So that's one thing. We need to shift the whole research agenda. The government, though, as I suggested, subsidized this whole move toward strict monocultures. And there is no reason why, with a different set of policies, changing the incentives, we can't move agriculture back. There is one reason why, actually. I'll get to that. We should, for example, instead of right now, our subsidies reward farmers by the bushel. How much can they grow of these five crops that we subsidize? We could reward them instead for diversification. For how many different crops do you have? We'll pay you more for every one you add to the rotation. Or we'll pay you to plant a cover crop in the fall, which very few farmers do today. Cover crops by themselves, another great technology, completely unglamorous. What they do is they keep soil from eroding over the winter when it's lots of snow on it. They build up carbon in the soil. Farmers don't do it. Why not? Well, they usually get a break if they spray their fertilizer in the fall because the fertilizer spreaders aren't as busy as they are in the spring. And they have a whole lot of reasons that have to do with their convenience and the fact that they're not rewarded for doing it. Nothing could do more to clean up the Gulf of Mexico than cover crops in Iowa and places like that. Fertility. You know, in the same way that cheap oil is a curse because it leads to profligate use, cheap nitrogen has been a curse too. And that there shouldn't be such cheap nitrogen, and there won't be when fossil fuel prices get high. It quadrupled in price during the oil spike. But we also need municipal composting. We need mandatory composting in our cities to generate compost to bring back to our farms. I mean, we're really just, you know, throwing out all the fertility that we're growing. To diversify farms, to really close this nutrient loop, you need to put animals back on farms. One of the things our subsidies did was allow farmers to sell their grain below the cost of production, and this sucked all the animals off of America's farms and put them on feedlots because the feedlot operator could buy grain more cheaply than a farmer could grow it. So it became uneconomical for farmers to have animals on their farms. This was a disaster from an environmental point of view, and I would argue from a cultural point of view as well. When you take animals off of farms and put them on feedlots, you are taking, this is Wendell Berry's line, you're taking a brilliant solution, which is to say the animals consume crop waste and give you fertility, and the plants feed the animals and get fertility from the animals. You take this brilliant solution, technology too, and you neatly divide it into two problems. You have a fertility shortage on the farm, where the crops are being raised, that you remedy with fossil fuel fertilizers. And then you have a fertility surplus on the feedlots, where you have these manure lagoons, where we're breeding things like swine flu, that, you know, this, you would think farmers would die for this stuff. No, they don't want it. It's got too many pharmaceuticals in it. It's got too much phosphorus in it. And so it sits there releasing methane and nitrous oxide into the air. Getting animals back on farms, very, very important. We should be subsidizing our farmers, and I do believe we should subsidize farmers, by the way. I don't think the answer is to go to a free market system in agriculture. It has never worked in any recorded civilization. Farming is subject to crises of overproduction that are just unavoidable. We can talk about that later if you want. But what we should pay them for, again, is for fulfilling the interests of the public, which we're not doing. We're out of phase. They did a good job. They did what we asked them to do. Now let's ask them for something else. And what should we ask them for? Well, the one big thing I would ask them for is sequestering carbon. Take this 700 million acres of farm and ranch land and manage it in such a way that it is taking carbon out of the air. Estimates are between 10 and 15% of all atmospheric carbon could be returned to the soil with sustainable agricultural practices. I'm delighted to hear Al Gore talking about this issue for the first time as part of the solution. And there are ways we could do that. We have to learn how to measure carbon better. We have to figure out the best ways to do it. But we know rotational grazing, where you move the animals every day, produces huge amounts of carbon in the soil. I can explain how later. We know that organic agriculture compared to conventional agriculture builds up the carbon in the soil. We know how to do this. We have to figure out how to measure it and how to reward farmers for it. And one of my big concerns about this cap and trade scheme is that the first bill to emerge from Henry Waxman's committee simply left agriculture out. We are not going to get a handle on climate change by ignoring agriculture, not when it represents a third of the problem. Why did they leave agriculture out? Because that's what Big Ag wanted them to do. They don't want to be involved. Because in addition to the carrots of paying farmers for sequestering carbon or generating, you know, energy, you need sticks as well. You need to take Tulare County, where vast amounts of methane and nitrous oxide are leaving these huge cattle confinement operations, and make them pay for that in the same way that power plants are going to pay for their emissions. So you need carrots and sticks in agriculture, and nothing.
Sorry about this, folks. Don't know what's going on. My little audio here pooped out. Hopefully I can get this back up and running. If you all just bear with me here. Michael Pollan has some great things to say, so I know it would be good if we could keep going with this talk here. Let's see what I can do.
Seas in Santa Cruz.
We listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1.
Hello, we're the Devil Makes Three. When we're not illegally downloading music from the internet, we're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.5 FM through every station in the house.
101.1, dude.
101.1, you fucked it up. Okay, let's try that again.
No way, that's the one.
It may surprise you, but for years, I did not celebrate a birthday. Well, that's partly because the everydayness and sameness of prison. It's also because I really didn't remember the day, and I was often surprised by a card from my mother, or my children, or my wife. They surprised me into remembering. Of course, that was years ago. As the freedom movement has grown, so has the significance of that date, for the movement has kept me alive and engaged in struggle. For that, I thank you all. That's because movements create social change. Some years ago, many years ago, the anthropologist Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing it ever has. Just imagine if we were there." I thank you for all you have done and all you intend to do. I love you all. On the move.
Energy
from death row.
You need sticks as well. You need to take Tulare County, where vast amounts of methane and nitrous oxide are leaving these huge cattle confinement operations, and make them pay for that in the same way that power plants are going to pay for their emissions. So you need carrots and sticks in agriculture, and nothing could do more to drive the whole system change that we're talking about than that. But you should also be rewarding farmers for creating bee habitat. We have a crisis of the honeybees right now. That is the result of monoculture. So let's reward them for taking out a row of almonds every, 50,000 rows and put in a row of flowers, of perennials, so that the bees stick around for the whole year. We should reward farmers for generating electricity for wind energy. We should, and this might sound weird, one of the most important functions of agriculture is to keep cities in check, stopping sprawl. We should reward farms in critical areas as bulwarks against sprawl. So again, the basic goal is to realign the public interest. What do we need as a society? And then reward farmers for giving that to us. Now, I said that there was an obstacle, and the biggest obstacle to what I'm describing is labor. We don't have enough farmers, I don't think, to grow sustainably. I said we were down to about 1 million. That's not enough. And as fossil fuel gets expensive or runs out, we're going to need more people on the land. It's hard to imagine 20 or 30 more million people on the land in this country. I actually think it's easier to move developing world agriculture in a sustainable direction, as much as Monsanto wants to, you know, bring their seeds to Africa. I think that it is a place where these kind of systems would work really, really well, because you still have a lot of people on the land. And industrializing agriculture there and driving them to the city seems like not a smart idea. But what do we do here? Well, we have to encourage the many people, the many young people today who do want to farm, make it possible. Make cheap land available to them, make an education in agriculture available to them. And there are signs that this is happening. For the first time, the new agriculture census that's done every 5 years found an uptick in the number of farmers in America, the first time in history. About 100,000 new farmers today over 5 years ago. Very small farmers, local farms, people at farmers markets, CSAs. So we have to make farming cool. We have to make it pay well. To encourage people to go back to the land. And the last thing we have to do on the farm is preserve farmland near our cities. That is one of the most important, most endangered resources we have. We are lucky in San Francisco that you don't have to travel hundreds of miles to get to good farmland. But we have to make sure it stays this way. In the same way that if you want to develop a wetland, you have to meet a very high bar of proof that is absolutely necessary, and you will be strongly discouraged from doing it. The same should hold true for prime A1 farmland, that you should have to provide a food system impact statement before you're allowed to develop it. Because once houses go up on this land, it will never be farmed again. I say that, although I just heard about there's an environmental group that is actually bulldozing defunct real estate developments in the Central Valley now. So I might be wrong about that. The Trust for Public Land is involved in a big project to actually return a subdivision to parkland. But the next step is farmland. And we should incorporate farms in our development schemes. We should reward developers in the same way we reward them for open space. We should reward them for including farms. I mean, what if we had farms in the middle of all those subdivisions instead of golf courses? Wouldn't that be great? With CSAs, with... Anyway, so that's the last point on farms. Now, you ask, can we feed the world this way? This is the big question. I get asked this all the time. And I'll tell you the really honest answer. I don't know. I really don't know. But the reason I don't know is we haven't tried. And a lot of people are prepared to give up before we try. I also know that there is a whole lot of slack in this system. Half of the grain we grow in the world is going to feed animals. And that the great slack is, of course, meat eating worldwide. I also know that a quarter of the food we're growing is simply wasted. So there is probably enough land to grow all the food we need for the 10 billion that are coming. The labor, I think, is really the big question. But, you know, before people, it's so interesting how people are just, they raise this question and then they turn to Monsanto. And, you know, we, by the same token, we don't know if we can run an industrial civilization without cheap fossil fuel. We don't know if we can do that either. But we know we have to try. We know we have to try. And the same goes for food. And it's not all or nothing. You commit yourself. You move in that direction, you shift the research agenda, we have the models, and what we need are the people and the commitment to do it. Now, level two. I'm going to go a little faster through level two and three. If the farms diversify, you know, somebody's got to buy that stuff. If they move to five crops in Iowa and there's nobody left to eat food in Iowa, That's not going to work. Right now, the grain elevator only will buy corn and soy if you live in Iowa. So we need to diversify the food marketplace. We need to build a real local food infrastructure. We need Four Seasons farmers markets in every town in America. Not expensive buildings. As soon as you had farmers markets that were not simply seasonal, and we have to remember the idea of a 50-week farmers market that we're all spoiled on here in California is quite rare in the rest of the world. But if you had indoor structures, beautiful structures, like the Boqueria in Barcelona, and Europe is full of these structures, you would have farmers growing produce under glass, more root vegetables, and more meat and cheese and all that kind of food would show up in those markets. So that's, I think, is a very important thing we need to do. The basic premise, though, here is we need to decentralize the food system. Now, you say that might be a little less efficient, and I will concede it is less efficient. But one of the most important lessons, I think, of the last few years is that as important a value as efficiency is, resilience, finally, is a more important value. And efficient systems, by definition, are not resilient. Because resiliency depends on redundancy, right? And by definition, that is inefficient, to do things twice. The advantages of decentralizing the food system are many, though. It will reduce fossil fuel consumption. But more important, the system can better withstand shocks. And the only thing we can be sure of going forward is that there will be shocks. Oil price shocks, weather shocks, pathogen shocks, terrorism shocks. And one of the real vulnerabilities of our food system, of this national food chain based on monocultures, based on only four companies selling all the beef, three grain traders, incredibly cinched waste economy of this food system, is that it is exquisitely vulnerable to accidental or deliberate contamination. We learned this after 9/11. The government went and was looking for all the different vulnerabilities in our society, and the GAO did a report, Government Accounting Office, and they said one of the biggest vulnerabilities of all is the food system. We have a single hamburger grinding plant that's feeding 50 million people over the course of a month. We have a single lettuce washing facility that's doing 26 million servings of salad every week. A single canister of poison introduced into those systems could kill huge amounts of people. And the government saw this threat and said, well, yes, we have a problem with centralized food production in this country, and then buried it because nobody wanted to go there. Nobody wanted to go there. But we need to go there. And if we relocalize the food system, we will be eating more real food because this system of monocultures feeds into a system of heavily processed food that can, the deathless Twinkie that lasts on the shelf for 2 years is very much tied to the system I'm describing. So the market is pushing things in this direction. There is an incredible ferment, lots of effort to relocalize food, but the government can do a lot to encourage it and to get out of the way in some ways. They need to deregulate small food processors who I talk to farmers all the time who are growing wonderful pork, but they're not allowed to smoke a ham without having $100,000 of facility because the rules are designed for Hormel, and the little farmer with his couple hams simply can't afford to be in that system. We need antitrust enforcement. That this food system is so heavily concentrated that even if we just went back to the level of antitrust enforcement of Dwight Eisenhower, we would have a completely different food system than we have now. I think the most important thing the government can do to create a renaissance of local food production and consumption would be simply to regionalize food procurement. Just, pass a law. In the same way we have a law that a certain amount of procurement for say, military contractors has to go to minority contractors because that satisfies a public goal. What if 1% or 2% of all the money the government spends on military bases, on prisons, on schools, went to local food production, food grown within 100 miles? That would do it. Just that. 2%. That's all we need. And we also need to develop urban ag, because there are lots of places where food can be grown in cities. And one of the most exciting things happening in this food movement that I didn't mention earlier is what's happening in our cities. If you go to Detroit, there's an amazing a project there to feed the city from the city. Will Allen is a visionary farmer in inner city Milwaukee who's growing huge amounts of food on 2 acres in the middle of Milwaukee and has plans to feed 10% of that city from his farm. So we need to support that kind of work. And there's evidence that this government will be supporting that. I think we've barely begun to test the potential of urban agriculture to deal with these food deserts, which are such a big part of the public health problem. So that's level two, the economy. There's a lot we can do. It's not that expensive. It just takes a commitment on the part of the government and a food industry that is willing to allow it to happen. And that may be the hard obstacle there. And level three is the food culture. The fact is,
All right, I'm going to stop it there. We are almost out of time for Your Homegrown Food, the show all about food. I'm your host, Wanda Fox, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 and freakradio.org on the internet. And if you would like to find out more about Michael Pollan, or if you would like to hear his complete talk, you can find it at fora.tv, or you can go to longnow.org, longnow.org, and you can find his talk there. Or you can also go to my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook, and I have a link to his deep agriculture talk. And what else can I say? We are coming down to the last few minutes of Your Homegrown Food Show. And it looks like there's about another maybe half an hour of Michael Pollan's deep agriculture talk. And I will play the rest of it next week. And you can tune in to Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday at 11:30. It's a half hour show, 11:30 to 12. And I hope you have been enjoying Michael Pollan's talk. He's a fascinating speaker. This is a really, really great talk. I know it's kind of hard to listen to it broken up, but it is a long talk, and I wanted you guys to hear the whole thing. Unfortunately, we have to do it in three segments. But if you would like to listen to the entire talk, like I said, you can find it on the internet, longnow.org, or at my Facebook page. You can go to Facebook, and my page is Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. And I also post lots of other good information about the alternative food movement. If you would like to follow me on Facebook, you can get links to most of the things I talk about on the show, including other things. I actually posted a link to a YouTube video of Michelle Obama's summit on childhood obesity. That's kind of a long video, but it's definitely worth listening to. Childhood Obesity Summit, the opening session. There's lots of government people there talking about the issue. And I think it's good to follow these things, because hopefully this means things are going to change with our national food system. We really need change, especially with the way children eat. So go ahead and go to my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show, and check out that video that I posted there. And this concludes our show for today. Tune in again next week, Wednesday at 11:30, for Your Homegrown Food Show. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.